Show Me the Way, the double acquisition with Joe Haidu. In this episode, we talk with Joe Haidu about his life experiences regarding the sale of the businesses that he has been involved with. And, oh yeah, by the way, he sold it once and then he sold it twice. So it's a unique situation that doesn't come up very often. This is a podcast presented by Spencer Fane LLC about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. Once again, joining me today on the show is Joe Haidu, formerly an owner in a business in the Midwest that had reaches throughout the United States. He had an amazing success story that he will share with us in growing the business he was involved with to the ultimate exit for himself. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If you would, Joe, let's talk a little bit about Joe Haidu first. Tell us about your background. Tell us a little bit about where you live. And tell us about how you got into the business of Veriflex.
So I guess, starting from after high school, I was not somebody that really was seeking higher education. And what I was really interested in was being entrepreneurial. And I went through several ventures in an attempt to build a successful business. And what I found was that that was much harder to do than I had anticipated. And I went through two or three different ventures and ended up with a group of people. There were three other people who had similar interests in the coatings industry. And what we were interested in doing was building a business, a manufacturing business of plural component coatings, specialized coatings for construction, industrial, and transportation applications. None of us had any manufacturing experience. We came from various backgrounds. Legal, we had a lawyer, some construction guys, and then my experience, which started off in athletic running tracks, playground surfacing for impact attenuation surfaces for McDonald's and so on. So we had heard about a new technology that had been developed by Texaco Chemical in the late 80s. And in 1993, we got together, we formed, well, we hadn't incorporated yet, but we essentially agreed to form a company. We went to Texaco and met with one of the developers of the technology, which was called polyurea technology. We met with him and told him what our aspirations were. And he said, well, we're interested in spreading the technology. It's new. It's extremely unique for a coating. And we'll give you some starting formulations, which is where we started. We developed, in the beginning, we developed three products. These products were, the technology really was designed for very fast application. Most, just to give you a bit of an understanding of two-component coating technology, most coatings are very sensitive to temperature as part of their cure cycle. So, for instance, an epoxy or a polyurethane may take several hours to actually go from a liquid to a gel state and then to a final tack-free state, which where it could take traffic. So in many cases, you're looking at applications that would take 8 to 12 to 24 hours before they can be utilized for traffic or for use. Polyurea technology was unique in that you could return it to service within an hour. You could literally put traffic on it within 5 minutes. And this was temperature insensitive, or is. So most coatings, the colder it is, for every 10 degrees, you add about an hour to the gel and cure time. So this material could be applied at 40 below zero. They were using this on the Alaska pipeline, spraying it in winter applications. So very, very unique technology, also insensitive to moisture. So very unique characteristics. So we were excited about the technology because we saw that there were a lot of great opportunities in the construction, industrial, and transportation markets for these kinds of applications, particularly where turnaround times are very important. You know, you're talking about process lines where they can't afford to be shut down for, you know, for more than a few hours because of the cost. So that's kind of where we started. We formed our company in 1994, incorporated it. Back then I was 35 years old. We had a small facility in Tulsa, Oklahoma, about 3,000 square feet. That was back, I think we got that and started manufacturing shortly after that. In 1996, we moved from Tulsa to Kansas City and set up a facility there. It was about a 10,000 square foot facility. And then in about 1998, 99, something like that, we moved into a 30,000 foot facility in Kansas City. And then finally in 2012, we ended up buying a building about 100,000 square feet, which ended up being the facility we operated in until we sold the company. And that the size of the square footage and so on kind of was paralleled our financial growth as well. We ended up our first year selling about $50,000 in product, and we thought we were doing great. at the end, right. When the product went up, or when the company went up for sale, we were at about $25 million.
That is exponential growth. Hey, so Joseph, thanks for that insight. It leads me to ask or to draw out some more thoughts from you, because it sounds to me like you either had a technology that didn't exist, I think that is true, that's part of it, and or technology that wasn't being applied in the construction industry, and now I take it is pretty universally recognized, at least in the United States. And that allowed you to grow your facilities, manufacturing facilities, and grow the business. So let's take a step back. If you could drill down a little bit about this technology, that it was new and its application and how you went about selling that. Because, you know, you bring something new to market and people are going like, you know, is it tested? You know, what is your experience? What's your history?
Sure. So the technology that was developed by Texaco Chemical, originally they were looking at applications in the automotive industry. And if you remember back to the 80s when they had there was a car called the Fiero. And it had a plastic body. And originally that body was made out of urethane systems. But they were having trouble with the urethane technology because of certain climate conditions that caused expansion and contraction. Like in, say, Phoenix, Arizona, people couldn't get their doors open. So Texaco is looking for a different technology that did not have a catalyst, what they call in the coatings business, autocatalytic. So it would be unaffected by external conditions for the most part. And so they were using this for rim injection, rapid injection molding. And they were spraying it for using it, either injecting it or spraying it for body panels.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked quite well for those applications. Of course, when we got into it, this started out of a need that came from, well, now it would be Costco. But back then it was Pace Warehouse, and they kind of started the whole bulk item discount shopping. And their model was they had these big warehouses with concrete floors, and they would shut their facility down at 10 o'clock at night, and they'd restock all the shelves using forklifts and other equipment. And then in the morning, they would open up at every time. We'd have to be out of there by 6 in the morning.
That's heavy work.
Yeah, so that they could open the store. And, you know, part of the problem with running, these were just regular warehouses with, you know, 6 or 8 inch slabs and concrete slabs. And so running heavy forklifts, a lot of these stores weren't really designed to be taking heavy load traffic. And so the concrete would crack and it would become a trip hazard for people.
Right.
And so they wanted a company to come in, a contractor to come in and fix these cracks in the concrete. And the problem was most of the epoxy and urethane technology, you didn't have enough time to go in and do the work and then have the product cure and open up for service the next morning. So we took as our first kind of foray into the business, we took this technology and actually had to modify it right out of the chute, because the technology was designed such that it would set into a solid state within about 10 to 15 seconds.
Oh, wow.
So it's not something that you could easily apply into, say, a control joint or a random crack. And so we had to slow the technology down, and we had some help from Texaco with that. But that was unique. And so we took the technology, we came up with three different products for three different applications on concrete, and that's where we started. And it was a huge deal to Pace Warehouse, because we could get in there and start, we could do our work, put the sealant down and have it open to traffic in the morning, and it was like did not limit their business in any way. So that was a big deal. I mean, it was small business, you know, but to us, it was a lot. And so from that, we kind of got our foot in the door in the industry, and we started to, you know, to develop newer products. We looked at spray applications, and we thought, wow, we could use this in other applications for like waterproofing. And it just so happened in 1996, there was a project in Boston called the Metropolitan Bay Transit Authority. Well, they have the train systems there. And they had a big facility that they were building, and they had about 500,000 square feet of underslab waterproofing that they needed, because locomotives and so on were going to be parking there, and they wanted to be able to capture any contaminants, fuels, things like that that could leach out. And so we ended up getting that contract. And that was about $1 million, $1.5 million in sales for us, which was huge, because we went from a few hundred thousand dollars in sales to, you know, all of a sudden this huge bump. And we didn't know much about the technology. We didn't know about primers. We didn't know about, you know, application. There was equipment available from one company. So from that actually kind of put us on the map. But, you know, prior to that, we struggled, and you know, we didn't have funding. We started our business. We each put $12,000 into the business. Wow. We had to borrow that because we didn't have we didn't have the resources. And early on, I remember our president at the time, Dave Cerchi, he called us all to Kansas City and said we have to have a meeting. I think this must have been. It was right before the MBTA project. And he said, we've got enough money to last for about 10 days.
Oh, wow.
And then we're out of business, guys.
Yeah.
Unless we can come up with $150,000. Well, none of us had that kind of money.
Wow.
And this was, probably 1995. So pretty quick after incorporating, we were starting to run into trouble. Anyway, we found somebody that was willing to put money into the business, and that really kind of saved us.
Wow.
And it took some good management. I mean, I had three other partners, and we all had experience in different areas, but none of us lived in Kansas City. Well, Dave Cerchi lived in Kansas City, but the others, one guy lived in Tulsa, the other in Steamboat Springs, and I lived in California. And so we operated remotely. And after getting that influx of cash, though, we had a couple other breaks. And in 1998, the big dig started.
Yep.
And that was the big Boston project, where they were taking all the flyovers and moving them in underground. That was a huge project, 3.5 million feet of waterproofing. There was a lot of controversy about that project, but in essence, the technology that we provided worked really well. There were different technologies that were used as well, and there were also construction aspects and design aspects that were questionable. But you know, it was cutting edge technology at that time. So, but that really helped kind of catapult us, you know, into the coatings industry. And at that time, we were competing with conventional systems, And on these projects for the MBTA and the Big Dig, they needed to work year-round, 24/7. And they couldn't be impacted by weather or other conditions, or, you know, they wanted to be impacted as little as possible. So the technology really, we had some lucky breaks, but the technology really made itself, you know, it became clear what the advantages of the technology were. And it, you know, we were dealing with some big companies like Bechtel and Parsons and the various agencies in, you know, with MassDOT and so on. So people began to really look at this technology and say, wow, this is pretty interesting. We could use this in other areas. So, you know, so our business really kind of began to grow in that area. And in 2000, we were approached by a guy who had a background in DOT applications for waterproofing bridge decks. He said, hey, you know, this technology would be great for waterproofing substructures on bridge decks, which is essentially if you've got an elevated structure, like a concrete structure, it could either be left bare, which in the northern states is problematic because you're putting salts on the surface to melt the ice. Of course, that migrates into the rebar and causes problems. So up in the northeast, typically what they'll do is they put a waterproofing membrane down and then come in and put an asphalt overlay on it. And so with this technology, we were able to go in and waterproof these decks, go in at night. They'd come in with milling machines, mill off the asphalt. We'd put a section of waterproofing down, and then they'd apply their asphalt over it. And that also worked on rail decks as well, where they could put waterproofing down and put their granite ballast over the top. The unique thing about this product and those applications is that, for instance, on highway decks, some of these decks are 200,000 or 300,000 square feet, and they want all this waterproofed at night, and then they want to drive traffic on in the morning.
Quick turnaround.
Right. So we ended up testing and developing a different composite system where we could go in and spray the main waterproofing down, come in with a slower setting material, broadcast aggregate into it, and then we could work up until an hour before they wanted to open the bridge.
Wow.
And we'd open it up and they'd be driving on it for rush hour.
Wow.
So for instance, we did the Brooklyn Bridge, the approaches to the Brooklyn Bridge, and they were running 150,000 vehicles a day over that. We had to go in each night and do sections. So it took, I don't know, a month to do, say, one side of the approaches, and they were running traffic on that when we weren't working.
Right.
And of course, they were running traffic on. And for rail applications, being able to put ballast directly onto a waterproofing membrane was unique. So, the product had very advantageous applications. And those are just kind of examples. And we grew that business from, it kind of hovered around $500,000 a year from about 2000 to 2008. It just never really did anything. And in 2008, I stepped in, and it was a separate entity. So I stepped in as president, CEO of that, and we took it up to about $5 million within a few years. But a lot of that was specification driven. So it was really, you had to get with the owners and really sell the technology. It more or less sold itself, but it was a very technical application, required certified applicators. So there was a whole program we had to put together to make that successful. But it was and still is. I mean, they're still out there doing it today and doing quite well. So anyway, those are just some of the highlights of the technology.
Fantastic that you shared that. Going back to your original statement here, I do believe you have a PhD, sir. It just may not be from a recognized California university, but clearly you understand this industry, and nothing succeeds for folks like real world experience. And when you're starting out with 50,000 and then growing it up to the exit that you engaged in, that's unusual. A lot of risk, right? A lot of heartache at times, some joy in there, and a real sharing of experiences with people to get to where you're at. thank you for sharing. I know that people listening in will look at that and take it to heart, because is there a business that doesn't have ups and downs? I'm not aware of one anyway. Let's talk a little bit about when it came to your attention that it might be time to sell the business. So you've been out now really since 1994 for, you know, 20 years selling. You're an owner, but you're out there selling and pushing the product. How did it come to your way of thinking and that of your group that, you know, maybe this is a time to sell? Is that a good question to ask, or does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, a time to sell really started at the beginning.
Interesting.
I mean, we were all in it for the money. What's funny is that in the beginning, it was really all about the money. We thought, you know, but we were pretty naive, or at least I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought we're gonna build this business up and sell it in 6 months or a year. And, you know, we're going to make a bunch of money on it. Of course, a bunch of money back then was different than what a bunch of money today is.
Right.
But we obviously, you know, reality set in, and it was like, boy, this is going to be a slog.
Mm.
And so we kind of dove in, and then we started to build our business, and other things began to happen. We started with 4 people, and then the business started to grow because we had to hire employees. We had to, you know, so it started to become, oh my God, we're now responsible for people.
Right.
And people have, you know, employees have aspirations and they have fears and concerns. And so all that begins to play into the mix. And then we began to build a reputation because we were one of the first companies out there to really kind of grab a hold of this technology and try and run with it. And so we started to develop a reputation. It was a good reputation. We had a reputation of building high quality products, and we had a lot of knowledge because, as I said earlier, when we first started the business, we didn't really have all the equipment. We didn't understand how the application was utilized, and it varied by application. So we had to develop all that. And so we really began to feel that we were kind of experts in the area of this technology. So My point is that what started off as we're going to sell this quick turned into, wow, you know, we're going to build this business, and this is becoming a community, a family kind of mentality.
Sure.
And not that we didn't have our moments. I mean, you know, we were all, the partners were all very different. And thank God, because it was what it took to help the company survive. I mean, we all looked at this thing differently. But somehow we were able to stick together and work through our differences and capitalize on our strengths. And by hook or by crook, it happened. But it was just a lot of perseverance and not giving up, quite frankly, and a lot of luck. But so we kind of cruised along until about 2009. And I was the youngest of the group. And the others were kind of going, you know, we need an exit strategy here. And we all started off as equal partners, but as time went on, some of the other partners had more resources than others. And so, you know, I ended up with a smaller portion of the business. And so just because of my financial circumstances. And so
sure.
I was thinking, hell, if we sell this thing now, you know, we had been in it for, let's see, it was 2009. We really started talking about that. So I was thinking, you know, we ran the numbers and, you know, it's like, I'm not going to make what I want to make because I wanted a substantial amount mm-hmm. when we exited. And so I was pretty much against the idea. And we looked around for a number of years trying to find the right partner. We weren't sure if we wanted to find a strategic partner, whether we wanted to find private equity or what we really wanted. And I think to a certain degree, we were kind of ignorant about how we go about this process. So it really started then. And, you know, in looking back at it, I think we tried to have some conversations as partners about what this meant. But I think it really would have been helpful to get some outside help. And I think we tried, We tried a couple of different consultants, but I don't know that they were it was necessarily the right pick for us. But I think that was because, you know, every one of the partners had a different idea and a different need, you know?
Yeah.
So in essence, nothing of any substance really happened until 2015, 16. And we had been approached by a company out of Dallas, Dalfort Capital, and they're a private equity group. And they were very interested in our business, and they had been talking off and on for a while. And so that's really where we started.
Mm-hmm. Did you find them, or did they reach out to you, or how was that connection made?
You know, Dave Cerchi was really the one who was doing a lot of the, I didn't really want to get involved in it. I just was kind of putting my head down and running with the business.
Sure.
So he really was the one searching. And we had a lot of people would call. I mean, we had some good size, some industry companies that were coming in and talking. But, you know, our valuation wasn't so good. You know, we weren't operating at peak efficiency just because we were a private business and, you know, we paid our employees well and we probably had too many employees and we weren't particularly efficient in that regard. So the valuation wasn't great. But Dalfour came in and they had kind of a different approach than what we had talked about with some of the other interested parties. And we were able to kind of clean things up too a little bit. So it bumped the valuation. And we had some decent sales and profits. So that kind of paved the way for that negotiation and eventual sale.
And out of that ultimate sale, you received obviously some money, but you also received stock in the company. So you stuck around, for lack of a better term.
Well, even at the higher value that we were getting through that acquisition, it really wasn't what I wanted. And more importantly, well, maybe not more importantly, but equally as important, was that I really wasn't emotionally ready to give the business up. And while I had run one of the divisions, the bridge division, I really had my sights on trying to run the whole organization. But that required moving from California to Kansas City, which I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about, but it was an opportunity. And like everything else we did, it wasn't necessarily what we wanted to do, but we did it because it, you know, seemed like the logical thing to do. So the way that Dalfort decided to set this up was that people who were owners who were interested in the business, who had stock in the business, could keep some or all of their stock. In my case, I originally was going to keep it all, but I didn't know the principles of this private equity group. And I guess suspicious would be a word, but I didn't know him. And,
right.
And I didn't feel completely comfortable. You know, I had worked with my partners for decades and I knew them. I trusted them. I knew how they operated. I'd heard horror stories about private equity, you know, and so I was very nervous. I had put 25 years into this thing and,
sure.
You know, and it was this kind of a, was I going to be outmaneuvered and, you know, lose my investment? It maybe wasn't rational, but it was what was going on in my head.
Right.
So I ended up selling about a third of my stock and keeping two thirds. I wish now that I kept it all because it would have been substantially more. But, you know, hey, I'm very happy with the final outcome. So I ended up pulling enough money out of the first bite of the apple.
Right.
That, you know, that I was able to feel some security. You know, I bought a house and paid cash for it. So if things fell apart, I had a place to live. And, you know, so, but quickly as we started these discussions, I thought I'm in over my head here in some respects because I just didn't know. And so I thought I need to find an attorney. I need to find somebody who understands this type of, you know, these acquisitions and you know, the complexities of it. And I need to protect myself. And so I contacted Spencer Fain, and it was actually recommended. You guys were recommended to me by another local attorney. Mm-hmm. And that's when I contacted you and Sue to talk about the acquisition and about a employment contract.
What I hear is, again, an individual who I think first and foremost, really in-depth relationship with the business and saw a future. You weren't really ready to retire, just punch out altogether. And why do I bring that up? Because I talked to some of the clients and folks that I deal with about what are they going to do in retirement. And what I'm always concerned about is, do they see something beyond the business, right? And if they don't, in my experience anyway, it's hard for people to separate themselves from the business. I mean, they're not ready for whatever reason. And so if you sell the business, are you running from something or running to something? You know, so to speak. But it to me, it always seemed like you had that part figured out and you knew how to proceed. I've seen some people that candidly can't sell their business because they don't know what's next. And the business and their life in the business brings certainty. And while I saw you and I thought you were struggling with that process, you managed to handle it and move forward.
Yeah, it was a challenge. I mean, I you know, in the 5 years we sold to Dow Ford in 2017, and then we ended up selling again and to industry, a public group, PPG, just in 2021. So in that period, you know, we ended up with three other acquisitions and a much bigger company. We were up close to $80 million. And there were a lot of moving pieces. Integrations. I mean, it was just, you know, different facilities, lots of employees. And it was actually kind of heartbreaking to go in and, you know, people that had been working with these companies, and you have to go in and you have to cut overhead. And, and so there was an aspect of that that was difficult and personally painful.
Mm. So you wound up evolving, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it was actually an interesting exercise. Mm. You know, I remember meeting with the board, you know, and yep. early on, and they're saying, "Well, we need to cut $1 million out of our overhead." It's like, what?
Whoa!
Because we had discussions about that before we sold the business, and it was just like, we can't do that. Well, you can. I mean, there's ways of doing it. There's lots of ways of doing it, and you know, we kind of lived in our own little vacuum, and so. We didn't have a lot of perspective, but you start bringing in other industry experts and people that deal with this stuff on a daily basis. And there are ways of doing things that we hadn't thought of. So that was very instructive, and not everything was personally painful, but I mean, it was, you know, there was some things that we did that were very helpful and, you know, weren't particularly painful, but that really helped the business out and really helped the bottom line.
And then you fast forward to the second sale that you had stock in the new entity, and were obviously you cashed out at that point. So you're completely out of the business. How much time did you have to devote in helping to the second sale, or was that pretty much handled for you?
The second sale really happened for me. And let me back up a little bit, because one of the things that I think it's important for, and of course, every person's situation is different, but one of the things that I realized after the first year is that, especially with additional acquisitions that we were taking on, I took the position of president for the company. And I realized that the business was operating at a level that I wasn't familiar with. And I did not feel comfortable trying to operate, you know, essentially faking it. And I mean, you can't fake it. I mean, there's a lot happening, a lot of moving parts. And I was kind of ill-prepared to operate a business of that magnitude. And so I ended up stepping out of the position of president, and I took on a lesser role because I felt that it was not doing the business any favors, and I felt like I could be more effective in other roles. And so I ended up, it was a bit of a humiliation, but I figured, you know what, at this point, and by then I began to realize this is going in a direction that I really need to start thinking about my exit, because mm-hmm. because I'm not going to be doing this forever, and I don't want to live in the Midwest forever. So, so I started to kind of think about it from a different perspective. And, you know, one of the things that Dalfour did quite well in the beginning was they laid out several financial scenarios saying, this is what you can expect given these parameters. And the financial reward was significant. And so I thought, I've worked my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife put up with it for, you know, 25 years. She had her own career. But, you know, it affected our whole family. It affected, you know, how we raised our children. I was gone a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I was gone most of the time. If I was home a week, a month, I was probably doing good.
Mm-hmm.
And so it put a lot of personal strain on the family. But, you know, so I was thinking, and my wife too, were like, we really should start thinking about an exit plan, especially with private equity, because, you know, it's a 2 to 5 year plan.
Right.
So, you know, I was also thinking in the beginning that it'd be nice to have a legacy that would pass on. I mean, it ended up that we were bought by PPG. So, you know, so they're already in the business, and people, it actually ended up being, I think, a very nice opportunity for the employees who stayed behind, because it's a good company. It's a strong company.
Right.
I mean, they're a multinational company. So in the end, I think it worked out about as good as it could,
mm-hmm.
given, you know, I had two bites of the apple, and employees who stayed behind were kind of welcomed with open arms by PPG, and they're still going through the integration, but because those things take time, but, you know, it'll be successful, and it's going to go in a different direction now. It'll go in directions that we probably had never anticipated.
You are, you guys are kind of the Daniel Boone of this technology. You just kind of led everybody into the great unknown, first beginning with flooring, moving to, you know, pipeline, moving to bridges, moving to, you know, payment, moving to big, big construction projects. You learned a lot from what I hear along the way. Thank you for being honest and open about, you know, what you knew, what you didn't know, and how you had to go figure that out. And knowing you somewhat, Joe, I think you've always been very honest about yourself and the people around you. So you knew what you could do and maybe what should be handed off to other people. The result is, I would say, from a financial standpoint, fantastic for you. But at the same time, it sounds like your experiences, you just learned a lot, and the evolution of individual, who is Joe Haidu. I would have been interested to have known you in 1994, because my sense is you've evolved quite a bit. And I say that as a compliment. Sometimes these kind of transactions can beat people down or wear them out, and they don't learn, or at least, shall we say, that through all of the failures and successes, they might look at the transaction differently. But it seems like you've received quite an education, if I may say it that way, and an experiential education.
Yeah, it definitely was. You know, and I think one of the things that I, you know, one of the takeaways was, you know, to be sensitive to the environment, to the changing environment that you're in.
Interesting,
And make adjustments to that. You know, I found the last 5 years to be emotionally wrenching just because of all the changes happening.
Mm-hmm.
And which was one of the reasons that I kind of came to, it's probably time to sell the business for me. I mean, it's time for my exit.
It's kind of a catalyst. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's important, you know, if there's advice I could give to people.
Please.
Everybody's different. Every situation is different. But I think it really requires being honest with yourself and really understanding what it is you're trying to achieve.
Right.
You know, because it's not just the money. I mean, there's all kinds of other things that come into this. There's, you know, there's passion, there's ambition, there's ego, there's all these things that come into play. And, you know, and then there's other forces that you can't control.
Right.
You know, we had the other partners who were just, it's like, I need to leave. I need to, you know, it's time for me to exit. I don't want to die at my desk.
Right.
And we had one of our partners who died of cancer, and, you know, he got his money and within a few months he was dead, you know, which was tragic. But, right. You know, on the other hand, for him, it was his whole life.
Mm.
You know, it's like it was what made him go, and it energized him. And I think without it, you know, I don't know that he would have known what to do with himself other than maybe go off and start another business. But, you know, for me, my health took a hit in the 5 years in the Midwest. And I, you know, it wasn't just 5 years. It was everything that led up to it, because the business sure. takes a lot out of you.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I want to live a quality life, I need to move on. And thank God I did, you know.
What's next for you, professionally and personally?
Professionally, you know, I don't have any real aspirations. You know, I'm living in San Diego now with my wife.
Good for you. Good for you.
This is like paradise. And I'm tending to my health.
Congratulations.
You know, I'm spending time with my wife and with my kids. We've got a grandson now. So I don't have,
Good.
You know, I realize this is what I wanted in retirement. I want to have the freedom to travel, mm-hmm. to go do things I want, to not have to be tied to a schedule other than to take care of my grandson. You know, so, I mean, I may at some point decide that I want to get involved in something, but right now I am just relishing in the freedom that I have and that my wife and I are in the freedom that we have, really. It's what you dream about when you're younger and you're working your butt off and trying to achieve this stuff, and you're just going through the slog. And, you know, it turned out, I have to say, I feel extremely fortunate the way things turned out, because a lot of this, well, there's no doubt about it. You just got to mm-hmm. gut it out, and it's just a lot of hard work. But there's also a certain amount of luck in it. You know, it's just being in the right place at the right time and meeting the right people, and having the right combination of partners, if you have more than, you know, if you have partners. It just is a lot that happens to make a company successful.
Well, I'd like to thank you for this education, because I got educated today. I think I'm going to refer to you as Dr. Joe from now on. You brought more information about what you've been through than I knew before. Thank you. What I see is a guy that, you know, who is a warrior in business, a business warrior. Started out, slogged all the way through to get to two exits, you know, finished really, as I say, you kind of slid into home plate by baseball analogy, kind of cut up and bruised, but you did everything that you needed to do and finished under terms primarily that were terms that you could live with and that you wanted. So I really thank you, Joe, for the education today, and I know the listeners will be impacted by it. It was very heartfelt, very honest, and very straightforward. So thanks for spending time. We look forward to hearing about your successes going forward, and I'm sure there will be many successes. So thank you.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. I mean, it's as I started thinking about it, and about kind of the journey we took, you know, it's been interesting, and it's certainly interesting for us, for my wife and I and my family, but I'm as I said, I'm very grateful that of the way things turned out, and it was a fantastic ride.
Thank you.
You know, so appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
If any of my listeners are in search of assistance as an outgrowth of this podcast, go to davidsider.com and schedule a free consultation. Also, please be sure to subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And again, thank you, Joe, and thanks to everyone. Look forward to talking with you all in the future. And I want you to know that this podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice, and it is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in the podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners should consult with an attorney on their distinct circumstances.